Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights has been receiving an awful lot of press lately, partly due to the recent film adaptation starring Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi, which has had mixed reviews. We'll come on to that. So today, I want to do a deep dive into what I think makes Wuthering Heights one of the greatest novels of all time. And spoiler alert, it's not just the romantic aspects. And then finally, I will have my hot takes for the film at the end of the video, so please do stick around for those. We'll see whether the film measures up to the novel. But first, I want to start with a hidden force that drives much of the story in Wuthering Heights, and one that isn't to do with love at all. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. 1. Revenge, Strength, and Futility. Wuthering Heights is often referred to as a kind of love story, and I actually do agree with this label, as I'll come on to later. But I think that more importantly, and more pertinently to much of the causal events in the main plot, it's a story of power, vengeance, and shame, and the existential emptiness of all of these things. To understand the storyline and why Heathcliff becomes such a self-destructive bastard, we'll have to look back into his childhood at the home of the Earnshaw family, that home being the eponymous Wuthering Heights. Prior to Heathcliff's arrival, the Earnshaws consist of Mr. Earnshaw, his eldest son Hindley, his daughter Kathy, the housekeeper Nellie, and the ill-tempered but hyper-religious farmhand Joseph. Heathcliff is brought back by Mr. Earnshaw after a trip to the port city of Liverpool. His ethnicity is kept purposefully rather ambiguous, but he's most often referred to as Romani, so that's the interpretation that I will go with here. Mr. Earnshaw takes Heathcliff in, and not only does he do that, not only does he embrace him as one of the family, he actively makes Heathcliff his favourite. When Nellie is telling the story to Mr. Lockwood decades later, she describes Heathcliff as just being a bit too indulged during this period and being made a little master of the house. Heathcliff and Kathy become firm friends during this period and spend much of their time misbehaving and going on little adventures through the Yorkshire moors, much to the annoyance of Mr. Earnshaw. Although at this point Heathcliff is still a somewhat ill-tempered child, and he and Kathy do manage to torment one another, which we'll come on to later, this is still probably the happiest that we see Heathcliff in the book. It's also in this esteemed early childhood that we're told Heathcliff learns to be prideful, though that is just Nellie's report, and she does really dislike him as an adult, so it's hard to ascertain whether this is 100% true. However, everything changes when Mr. Earnshaw dies and his son Hindley inherits the house. Hindley has nursed a dislike for Heathcliff for many years because he sees Heathcliff as having stolen his father's attention and affection from him. So already, even before the book has really begun in earnest, and before the love story is properly introduced, the tale is already about revenge. It's the revenge that Hindley is now taking on Heathcliff for his perceived transgressions. And from that time on, Heathcliff is brought low in the Earnshaw household. He's transformed from a full member of the family to the lowliest of their servants. He is beaten and terrorized by Hindley, but the thing that really stings him, that kind of gets inside his soul, is the social shame and dishonor of it all. He was something and now he is nothing, and he vows revenge against Hindley. He will one day bring Hindley as low as Hindley has brought him. I think most tellings of Wuthering Heights really underestimate the importance of this motive to Heathcliff's later actions. Hindley is the primary reason that Heathcliff is so impoverished and shamed such that he and Kathy cannot be together. And in many ways, Hindley as a character is kind of the linchpin on which the plot of Wuthering Heights turns. A broad cycle repeats itself many times in the first part of the book, the part dealing with Heathcliff's childhood. Heathcliff is felt ashamed by someone or something, and he takes this shame and nurtures it in his heart, slowly transforming it into hatred and a vow of vengeance. Take Edgar Linton, for example. Edgar is from a rich, gentlemanly family, and as a child, he does occasionally condescend to Heathcliff. He's also a rival for Kathy's affections. But Edgar doesn't consciously victimize Heathcliff, like many of the characters in the novel. It is largely the sheer distance in their social position and the knowledge that Heathcliff once held a position that would rival Edgar's, and this was snatched away from him, that causes Heathcliff to hate him so much. This, as much as his possession of Cathy as her husband, is the thing that Heathcliff despises about Edgar and what fuels his revenge against him. And in focusing on the tumultuous love that festers between Cathy and Heathcliff, which will be the topic of the next section, we often forget that Cathy dies at around the halfway point of the novel, and Heathcliff continues living and tormenting others for the next 200 pages. Heathcliff says multiple times that Cathy is his reason for living. She is his soul and his life. But if that were, strictly speaking, true, he would surely have ended his own life when Cathy died. Instead, he is motivated enough to continue this decades-long vengeance quest. If there is a fixed idea, a thing that is lodged in Heathcliff's soul, it is just as much revenge as a concept as it is Cathy as a person. But if you want to get revenge on some of the subjects that you're finding particularly difficult, then you should check out today's sponsor, Brilliant. We all know that studying STEM topics like maths or science or programming can be really difficult. These can get unintuitive rather quickly, which often presents real hurdles for students. But this is where Brilliant comes into play. Brilliant has added a huge number of topics this year, so you can learn anything from programming with functions to probability theory to learning the ins and outs of large language models or classical mechanics. And additionally, Brilliant's learning is based around completing activities, which means you can learn by putting the very things you're learning directly into practice. And this both improves retention and just stops it getting boring. Brilliant also personalizes your learning, which ensures that you improve at a steady pace. If you want to work on your own critical thinking skills, you might want to check out the logic courses on Brilliant, which will just let you see what logic is all about. And with even a little bit of logic, the world can become a whole lot clearer. To learn for free on Brilliant for a full 30 days, go to brilliant.org/unsolicitedadvice or scan the QR code on screen, or you can click the link in the description. I don't mind which. Brilliant's also giving my viewers 20% off an annual premium subscription, so please do check that out. But anyway, back to the video. And when Heathcliff returns to Wuthering Heights, now an adult and having made a lot of money through unknown means, he does take his vengeance in a variety of extremely calculated and cruel ways. Firstly, he utilizes Hindley's gambling addiction to take legal possession of Wuthering Heights. Then he seduces Edgar Linton's sister, Isabella, marries her, and torments her until she flees the household, pregnant with Heathcliff's son. Thus, he deprives Edgar of the sister that he loves. Once Hindley's dead from drinking, Heathcliff takes possession of Hindley's son, Hareton, and he treats Hareton in the manner that Hindley once treated Heathcliff. He makes sure that the boy cannot read nor write, and does all he can to turn him into a spiteful and resentful young man, not entirely successfully. Years later, after Isabella's death, he takes in their son, and through some complex schemes, forces Edgar and Cathy's daughter, also called Catherine, to marry him. And then Heathcliff torments his own son to death, and through legal machinations takes possession of both Wuthering Heights and Edgar Linton's house, Thrushcross Grange. For all intents and purposes, Heathcliff wins his revenge near completely, though of course, Cathy has died over 10 years past at this point. And the thing that really sticks out, at least for me, is just how miserable this all seems to make Heathcliff, how little it makes him happy. The opening of the book is told from the perspective of this Mr. Lockwood, who is a wealthy visitor to the moors who has rented Thrushcross Grange for a year from Heathcliff, long after Heathcliff's revenge has officially concluded. Through Lockwood, we get to see Heathcliff through the eyes of a relatively neutral party, and we sort of see that Heathcliff is a wreck. His victory has won him no actual joy, and all he seems to do is brood on his estate, cursing his fate and terrorizing Hareton and the young Catherine, who remain under his roof. It's clear that whatever Heathcliff had hoped to gain from his vengeance doesn't quite come to pass. At some point along the road, his spite assumed the driver's seat, and the rest of Heathcliff's mind was just a passenger. Obviously, there are plenty of stories where revenge turns out to be bitter or not worth it, and the vengeful protagonist learns their lesson. But Heathcliff never really does learn it. He even says outright that he is unrepentant to Nelly. And the only reason why he doesn't stop and doesn't burn down Thrushcross Grange and Wuthering Heights as to deprive Hareton and Catherine of a home when he is gone is because he just sort of runs out of steam. Effectively, he dies almost as spiteful as he has lived, having been now overshadowed by the younger, physically stronger Hareton, and in practice, driven back into a small part of his house, and he just dies there, as helpless and pathetic as he was as a small child, though seemingly given a temporary peace because death is so near. This whole grisly affair, the entire plot of the book, has won him nothing and cost the happiness of everyone around him. And for me, the thing that makes this revenge narrative so extraordinarily done is that Emily Bronte sort of has you on Heathcliff's side for quite a lot of the start of the book. When you're reading about Heathcliff's torment as a child, you are drawn to his side. You want to see him get his own back at the people who've abused him and looked down on him. But then his revenge passes from those who victimized him to just those who made him feel ashamed even accidentally. And then it passes on to their children, people who are undoubtedly innocent of any wrongdoing. And it quickly becomes clear that things are spinning out of control. Even if Heathcliff says he never regrets his vengeance, the reader is made to regret supporting it. The futility is clear to us, if not to the revenger. And Heathcliff's revenge also fails in another vitally important way. I think that a lot of Heathcliff's position in the book is taken up with a fear of being powerless and a fear of being at the bottom of the rung, so to speak. And so he spends much of his life really attempting to get to the top of his local social ladder. He rises from Hindley's lowly servant and Edgar's social inferior to the master of both of their houses and the terror of their children, which, at least in the case of Edgar, was what he loved most. Heathcliff seems to desire this social power so that he can prove himself worthy in the sense that he was deprived of as a child and was the reason why he could never marry Cathy. But weirdly, it's in his encounters with Lockwood, this man from London who is seemingly wealthy enough that he can rent Thrushcross Grange for a year and not even lodge in it for most of that, presumably renting somewhere in London as well. And it's in their exchanges that we see how little Heathcliff has actually risen in the grand scheme of things, and how easily he can be brought low again. I'm thinking of one encounter in particular, where Lockwood tells Heathcliff that he is not renewing his tenancy at Thrushcross Grange and is going to London. Heathcliff reacts as follows. "Oh, indeed. You're tired of being banished from the world, are you?" he said. "But if you be coming to plead off paying for a place you won't occupy, your journey is useless. I never relent in exacting my due from anyone." "I'm coming to plead off nothing about it," I exclaimed, considerably irritated. "Should you wish it, I'll settle with you now." And I drew my notebook from my pocket. "No, no," he replied coolly. "You'll leave sufficient behind to cover your debts if you fail to return." I have barely seen anyone talking about this exchange, but I think it's really important. It illustrates that, ultimately, Heathcliff is just a big fish in a small pond. Lockwood is a genuinely wealthy and seemingly socially powerful man, and when Heathcliff tries to financially intimidate him, Lockwood immediately and effortlessly puts him back in his place, without even being conscious that that's what's happened. Heathcliff backs down, and we as the reader are made aware that for all of his attempts at becoming extraordinarily wealthy and powerful, there is always someone who can make him feel small again. And once he's less physically powerful than Hareton, and when Hareton is no longer just his obedient slave, Heathcliff instinctively retreats into a small corner of his own house. And Hareton doesn't even threaten him about this. Heathcliff just feels his own powerlessness and retracts in. He's reminded that he is still just a man and is still helpless in so many ways. Heathcliff's goal of ensuring a kind of power-based safety and sense of worth for himself has utterly failed, even if he succeeded in tormenting all the people he wanted to torment. It's tempting when we discuss things like resentment in Wuthering Heights to compare Heathcliff's experience to Nietzsche's analysis of ressentiment in The Genealogy of Morals, but ultimately I think this would be a mistake. The man of ressentiment, in Nietzsche's philosophy, attempts to repudiate the values of the people that they feel ressentiment towards, and ultimately they succeed. The slave class overturn the values of those that repress them, and thus create good and evil in that particular form. But this is pointedly not what we see from Heathcliff. Heathcliff doesn't repudiate the values of Hindley, or of the social system that means that he could not be with Cathy. Instead, he tries to emulate them as much as humanly possible. He spends his entire life trying to clamber to the top of this pre-existing value system. But this forms its own kind of tragic fate. Because in taking revenge on Hindley, and especially in how he treats Hareton, Heathcliff effectively ends up imitating Hindley. He becomes the very thing that he hated so much as a child. And so is it any wonder that he turns into such a wretched and self-despising adult? Ultimately, although Heathcliff has tried and arguably succeeded on his first-order quest to take revenge against everybody else in his life, in doing this, he has wrought a far worse crime on himself. Because he's wasted his life. He's wasted the entire thing in this futile endeavour that never seemed to bring him any happiness. Whatever havoc he wrought on other people has always been paid back to him by himself. It's only his approaching death and the prospect of seeing Cathy again that eventually brings him release. And let's talk about the relationship between Heathcliff and Cathy, or the elder Cathy, we might say, because it is the part of the novel that grabs people's attention so much, and I think that's for very good reason. 2. Eldritch Love. In the wake of this new film, there has been a great online debate about whether Wuthering Heights is a love story. On the one hand, there are people who find the love between Cathy and Heathcliff somewhat admirable or aspirational, and think of it as true love. On the other hand, there are those that point to the fact that Cathy and Heathcliff do make one another absolutely miserable, and spend an awful lot of the book hurting one another deeply, and thus argue that this is not a love story in any sense of the word. Well, personally, I fall somewhere in the middle of these two camps. I think that Wuthering Heights is a love story, but it's just a love story of powerful, amoral love. We've inherited a whole bunch of ideas about love from our particular cultural context that almost certainly originate by smushing some concepts from Christianity about the ennobling power of God's love into romantic love. Simon May talks about this in his History of Love. As a result, we tend to think of romantic love as something that is inherently good or inherently makes those in love better people. Love is meant to bring out the best in us. It's meant to transform us morally as well as emotionally. For May, this is a job that romantic love has culturally inherited from the holy, omnipotent love of God, which was meant to transform us from the inside out and make us good Christians. As a result, we've become loath to call anything love which doesn't meet this rather stringent moral criterion. But on reflection, this makes very little sense if you see love as a human endeavour, if it's a natural emotion in the natural world partaken in by us imperfect human beings. Then surely we'd expect it to come in all kinds of forms, happy or unhappy, good or evil, ecstatic or calm. We don't do this definitional moralizing about practically any other emotion. We don't say things like, well, if your anger isn't good, it isn't true anger, or if your fear isn't irrational, then it's not true fear. But we do this with love. And I think part of this is because love forms such a unique point of our value system. What Bronte does, that is part of the reason, I think, that we're still talking about her analysis of love almost 200 years later, is that she presents love as both immensely powerful and psychologically motivating, but also as deeply amoral. Love doesn't necessarily make people better, and sometimes it even brings out their worst qualities. We'll come on to the main event of Cathy and Heathcliff in a second, but I actually want to begin by talking about Hindley. One of the few things we're told about Hindley that's actually rather endearing is that he really loves his wife. But this doesn't make him a kinder person in the slightest. He is kind specifically to her, sure, but he's still a complete bastard to everyone else. We're even told that he is crueler to Heathcliff, who at this point is a child, once he is married, because his wife dislikes Heathcliff. So Hindley actually steps up his abuse out of love and deference for his own wife. Moreover, since his wife dies shortly after childbirth, this causes him to neglect their son Hareton, because at some level, he probably blames him for his wife's death. When his wife is dead, Hindley turns to drink and proceeds to drink himself into an early grave over the course of many years. For Hindley, love did not make him a better person, and when it was gone, it left him even more wretched than he was before. Another good non-Cathy Heathcliff example is Isabella Linton, who is probably the most straightforwardly and uncomplicatedly tragic character in the book. She sincerely loves Heathcliff, and she even leaves her family to be with him. But this love doesn't aid her or make her happy in the slightest. Instead, it leaves her totally at the mercy of Heathcliff, who doesn't love her back and never will. He's simply using her to torment Edgar and Cathy. Isabella Linton's love causes her to effectively destroy her own life. It creates this opening for Heathcliff to take advantage of, and although it doesn't make Isabella herself cruel, it facilitates cruelty all the same. This link between love and opening yourself to harm is also shown in Edgar, who is victimized by Heathcliff primarily through how Heathcliff hurts the people that Edgar loves, like Isabella or the younger Catherine, Edgar's daughter. Of course, the most famous romance in the novel is the deeply unfulfilled romance between Cathy and Heathcliff. And I think it's here that we find both the most detailed examination of love and an emphasis of its really quite cruelly double-edged character. Cathy and Heathcliff are attracted to one another at what I can only describe as a near ontological level. It's difficult to explain this, but I think that we can somewhat appeal to our own experiences of love or infatuation to make sense of it. For example, when I was a little bit younger, I remember being in a deeply unhappy relationship, yet also finding myself unable to leave, because my attachment to this other person felt somehow even more significant than joy or happiness. It was like they felt required for my being. I recognize that this is a somewhat embarrassing and irrational feeling, but as I've said before, and I'll say many, many times in the future, love is quite often these things. Gradually, the internal belief shifts from, if I had this person, I would be happy, to, I need this person even if I'm not happy. And I think in many ways, Cathy and Heathcliff's love is an extreme and somewhat exaggerated version of this phenomenon. They desire one another more than joy itself. I mean, even when they're very young, they often seem to fight and torment one another, with Heathcliff resenting the social distance that's been placed between them, and Cathy being somewhat spoiled and deliberately provoking Heathcliff. Though, funnily enough, I think that both the power and the suffering involved in Bronte's conception of love are found most potently, at least, during and after Cathy's death. Heathcliff reacts to Cathy dying not with straightforward grief or sadness, but like furious, uncontrolled anger. He says this to her as she's dying. "You teach me now how cruel you've been, cruel and false. Why did you despise me? Why did you betray your own heart, Cathy? I have not one word of comfort. You deserve this. You've killed yourself. Yes, you may kiss me and cry and wring out my kisses and tears. They'll blight you. They'll damn you. You loved me. Then what right had you to leave me? What right? Answer me. For the poor fancy you felt for Linton. Because misery and degradation and death and nothing that God or Satan could inflict would have parted us. You, of your own will, did it. I have not broken your heart. You have broken it. And in breaking it, you have broken mine. So much the worse for me that I am strong. Do I want to live? What kind of living will it be when you, oh God, would you like to live with your soul in the grave?" Heathcliff's sheer avaricious need for Cathy perversely makes him behave really selfishly in this moment, tormenting her as she lays dying, and she torments him in return. When Cathy is dead, he often says that that he hates her or is angry with her, even as he continues to long for her right up until he meets his own fate. Some might argue that this thing that exists between Cathy and Heathcliff isn't love. And indeed, it doesn't fit Thomas Aquinas's classic definition of wishing the good of the other for their own sake. But shouldn't we confront the fact that love can be selfish and greedy, and that it can manifest as intense self-concern, especially when the object of your affections is threatening to be taken from you? Can't we recognize that love, just like any other powerful passion, can shoot off in the direction of good or ill? Perhaps the most interesting aspect of Heathcliff and Cathy's love, and I think this builds upon this more general point quite nicely, is that they both talk about it as if it puts them in touch with some kind of higher reality, beyond Earth and maybe even beyond God or heaven. Cathy famously says that whatever souls are made of, hers and Heathcliff's are the same. And this language comes up an awful lot. They both quite often talk in terms of souls and grand mystical phenomena to describe how they feel for one another. Funnily enough, and this was really kind of serendipitous, I suppose, when I was working on this video, I happened across a book by the philosopher Mark Fisher called The Weird and the Eerie, where he discusses various forms in which these two concepts appear in literature. I actually haven't finished it yet, but it was really quite relevant for Wuthering Heights, because the way that Cathy and Heathcliff love one another actually fits in very nicely with one of the essays he has that explores a particular definition of the weird. For Fisher, at least in this essay, the weird refers to a phenomenon that puts the experiencer, often a character in a novel, in touch with some other reality that is beyond this material plane. Not necessarily heaven, or even some beneficent plane, but it allows them to connect with somewhere otherworldly and out of this existence. This weird aspect is for Cathy and Heathcliff, because I really do think that their love taps into this weird in Fisher's sense. I think it explains why their love is so motivating for them, but also so destructive, because for both of them, the love is imbued with such a devastating felt significance, because it almost seems to transcend every worldly concern. And that makes sense if we see it as an experience within the context of the novel, that at least the characters seem like they're experiencing some kind of beyond. That's how they process their feeling here. I do think that there's pretty good textual evidence to support this, because I think it's pretty explicitly embodied in the fact that Heathcliff pointedly rejects heaven in favour of Cathy. So near the end of his life, he says this, and this is when he's dying, by the way. "No minister need come, nor anything be said over me. I tell you, I have nearly attained my heaven, and that of others is altogether unvalued and uncoveted by me." His heaven, of course, refers to this future that he might inhabit as kind of ghostly apparition with Cathy. And he is explicitly rejecting the Christian heaven, you know, pure bliss, in favour of this. And I think these are probably some of the most revealing statements in the novel. There's no sense in which Heathcliff or Cathy are atheistic. They do seem to believe pretty explicitly in the Christian God. And so Heathcliff here is effectively throwing away his chance at eternal peace for Cathy. It reminds me of that cry of Milton's Satan in Paradise Lost, where he says, "It's better to reign in hell than serve in heaven." But in both cases, it speaks to a seriously self-destructive state of mind, almost. Cathy and Heathcliff both perceive one another to be more important than God or heaven or happiness. And that's part of what makes their love so incredibly painful, and also so incredibly powerful, but also why it ends in such disaster and unbearable suffering. I also think it's why their love is so narratively compelling from a reader's standpoint. And I can kind of understand why, in the abstract, it becomes the object of a sort of fantasy for some readers. Although a love like this is pretty horrible in practice, and is pretty horrible in detail in the book, there is something enticing about someone loving you to such extremity and intensity that they would be willing to discard God for the sake of being with you and discard heaven as well. I've seen similar romanticizations of some of the denizens of Dante's hell, specifically those condemned there for the sake of lust or forbidden desire for another person. If people are fantasizing about a love like Heathcliff's, I don't think that necessarily means that they have inherently like missed the point of the novel, or that they would actually want this in practice. Sure, it could be the case, but it could also be that through Bronte's genius, in effect, the reader is feeling the same kind of temptation that Cathy might, to have someone be so important to you and desire you so much that you are the fulcrum on which their world seems to turn. Personally, I see the idea that Wuthering Heights is a straightforward tale of love, and the idea that it's a warning against love and this kind of love, to be too simplistic. I think they're both missing something. If the book really could be boiled down into one of these two phrases, I highly doubt that it would just fascinate people in the way it does. Similar to how, at the beginning of the novel, we desire Heathcliff's revenge and then are subsequently horrified by it, I think the really interesting part of Cathy and Heathcliff's twisted yet compelling desire for one another is that, from a reader's perspective, I think many of us end up feeling strongly ambivalent about it. We're drawn to it at one level and repelled by it at another. When Heathcliff loves Cathy near the start of the novel, we sort of want them to be together, despite the fact that, you know, they might not make the healthiest pair, because even then they're kind of sniping at one another. Then, as Heathcliff becomes more vengeful and cruel, we desire their union less and less, and especially at the height of Heathcliff's villainy and when Cathy is long in the ground. But finally, at the end of the book, when Heathcliff is approaching his demise, he begins to see Cathy. Whether this is a true ghostly apparition or just a hallucination is never quite made explicit. But the effect on Heathcliff, at least, is immediate. He becomes slightly happier, more relaxed. In his delirium, he attains a strange sort of satisfaction. Clearly, the prospect of being with Cathy again is highly comforting to him. And he even manages to slightly abate the hatred that he held for her since she married Edgar. At the very end of the novel, we're told that Heathcliff and Cathy's spirits have been sighted roaming the moors, together for all eternity, and since they're still on Earth, presumably barred from both heaven and hell. That state, being trapped between bliss and torment, is in many ways the metaphysical culmination of Cathy and Heathcliff's entire relationship, and the reader is left kind of unable to decide exactly what to think about it. Will they be happy now? Will they continue to torture one another? Will they oscillate between the poles of ecstasy and fury forever, never knowing rest, but knowing the heights of joy and misery instead? And I like this ambivalence. I like the fact that we are not quite sure exactly what to make of Heathcliff and Cathy, and whether their love makes them ultimately worse or better, or happy or miserable, or perhaps all of these things at the same time. It's the perfect encapsulation of how I think Bronte presents love, as both powerful and amoral. Something that can take over someone's life, but also fundamentally stretches beyond categories like good or evil or happy or unhappy. It's just unaware of them. And the reader is left to decide what to make of this fundamentally weird phenomenon. And lastly, we come to the love of Hareton and the younger Catherine. In many ways, I think they begin as a mirror of Heathcliff and Cathy. There's clearly something of a romantic tension there, but Hareton feels like Catherine looks down on him, and Catherine thinks that Hareton is cruel and a brute. Despite this, they gradually grow closer until they end up with something like love. And it's a love quite unlike that of Hindley or of Heathcliff or of Cathy or of Isabella, in that they show slowly and imperfectly that two people can begin to make one another happier and better. Catherine teaches Hareton how to read, and although we're told that she doesn't have the patience of a philosopher, the two of them stumble towards joy together. Apart from the idea that philosophers are particularly patient, I'm not quite sure where Bronte got that one, I really like this description of a much more gentle, human kind of love towards the end of the book. Hareton and Catherine are improved by love, slowly but surely, and we are put in the mind of assuming that this trend will continue once the book story has finished. I think that, again, this is a good argument against the idea that Bronte is outright cynical concerning love. She's said a lot about how lovers intensified people's worst aspects or left them open to harm or has dominated their whole life in a way that defies simple categorization. But here she chooses to close the book on the beneficial directions that love can take. So, over the course of Wuthering Heights, Bronte manages to cover the entire spectrum of love's effects. The only thing we can say for sure is that no one leaves love unchanged. It's presented almost like a capricious spirit in the manner of the Greek goddess Aphrodite, or even an eldritch horror. The chaotic and unpredictable force of erotic love works through the characters of the novel and can lash out in any direction, with the only constant being its raw, fearsome power. Though, personally, I think that maybe the most interesting theme in the book isn't necessarily to do with love or romance at all. It's to do with something much more fundamental. 3. Perspectives and forgiveness. Right, everyone get your unsolicited advice bingo cards ready because I'm about to mention Dostoevsky. One of the phrases that you'll hear about Dostoevsky in much of the scholarship and criticism around him is that he pioneered the polyphonic novel. That is, a novel where different perspectives are shown on a given philosophical issue and the reader is left to untangle the tension. It's a bit like a Socratic dialogue, but with more murder and fully integrated into the plot. When I was rereading Wuthering Heights for this video, it struck me just how much this label could apply to Bronte's book as well. Not necessarily because she employs different perspectives in a novelistic, quasi-philosophical dispute, but because much of the novel itself is about perspective. Firstly, it's easy to forget this when you're immersed in the story, but we're being told the tale of Wuthering Heights through two perspectival layers. We read a story that's told to us by Lockwood, who has in turn been told it by Nelly. So, yeah, that's two levels of potential distortion created by the retelling. And this immediately teaches the reader to just be ever so slightly skeptical of the details of the tale. Lockwood is a stranger to these lands. He's an outsider looking in, and thus he may be unable to grasp the particular nuances and complexities involved in the situation. In the aspects of his attitude that we are shown, he often treats the story as a bit like a kind of evening entertainment session, because after all, it's not something that he's particularly emotionally involved with or affects his life. It's just a bit of gossip that Nelly is telling him that he finds amusing. Nelly, on the other hand, is at the opposite end of the spectrum. She is far too close to the situation to possibly have anything approaching a neutral view on things. She has really complicated emotional attachments to almost every one of the primary characters, and indeed, she is one of the primary characters. So it's pretty hard to distinguish where her reporting of uncontroversial facts ends and her addition of personal idiosyncratic interpretation begins. Within the tale itself, it's worth noting that many of the conflicts are ultimately clashes of perspective. Heathcliff is brought into the Earnshaw household as an infant. There are a set of bare physical facts about him, like size, ethnicity, parentage, and that sort of thing. Things that everyone should be able to agree on. At the very least, you know, they're physical. Our observations about them are convergent. But then the Earnshaw family must discover who they want Heathcliff to be within the context of that household. Mr. Earnshaw interprets Heathcliff as roughly a member of the family, and although he's frustrated by Heathcliff's misbehaviour, he ultimately embraces him as a favourite. Hindley, on the other hand, interprets Heathcliff as an unwanted interloper, fit to be a servant at best and cast out of the household at worst. Cathy interprets him to be somewhere between a friend and a plaything. She initially rejects him as an infant, but then the two of them become inseparable, but with her always occupying a sort of higher status territory, if that makes sense. Thus, Heathcliff arrives already an object of interpretive and perspectival dispute. When he's older, he himself will join this interpretive battle for his soul, asserting himself to be a powerful man, worthy of authority, and then he will demonstrate this interpretation by returning to the moors as rich. intertwined with the person that Heathcliff is all manner of social and personal interpretation that dictates how he is treated and viewed and ultimately limits his options. The fact that Heathcliff is seen and interpreted as socially degraded is what keeps him and Cathy apart when they were younger. But the perspectival battles over who Heathcliff is don't stop there. Then there's the question of his actions upon his return, and he seems to view them as retaliatory. His revenge on Hindley is justified by Hindley's own sins, up to and including the fact that Heathcliff really mistreats Hareton, Hindley's son. His torment of Isabella is justified as an assertion of independence and a way to torture Edgar and Cathy, both of whom he perceives as wronging him because they've got married. And all the way to the end of the book, Heathcliff maintains a kind of stubborn justification for his actions, which very few readers and no other characters agree with, but it remains his interpretation of events. And I think that this kind of stubborn inhabiting of his own perspective at all times is reflected in quite a lot of his behaviour in the book, and he's not the only one. For example, take that line about heaven from earlier. I have nearly attained my heaven, and that of others is altogether unvalued and uncoveted by me. Here, we see that Heathcliff is clinging to his own perspective on the world to the exclusion of all others, and even rejecting what he imagines God's interpretation would be. There are many ways that we can analyse Heathcliff's character, and we've already looked at his resentment as well as his love. But I would argue that actually his defining characteristic, the thing that really is at the root of a lot of his behaviour and qualities, is this dogged commitment to his own viewpoint and his own interpretation of reality, and his absolute refusal to admit that it could be wrong or recognise anyone else's perspective. And this relates to what I see as the primary characteristic that separates those characters who do manage to conjure up some fulfilling human connection in the novel and those who do not: their ability to step into another person's perspective. Take Cathy and Heathcliff, because Heathcliff is not the only person stuck in their own eyes. Despite their strong mutual desire, they end up despising one another just as much as they love one another. And why is this? In my view, it's because they are totally unable and basically unwilling to see the world from the other's point of view. Cathy's death scene is an excellent example of this. They both declare love, but they also spend a lot of it just blaming one another. We saw that earlier. Even at this final moment, their tone is accusatory in the extreme at points. Cathy can't understand Heathcliff's anger, and Heathcliff can't understand why Cathy married Edgar Linton. And in each case, they are too blinded by their own pain and grief to see how things might look differently to the other person and incorporate the other person's experience into their map of the world. Sure, they were initially kept from marrying due to pretty strict social restrictions, but this in itself can't cause them to hate one another. What causes the conflict and the bitter hatred is this lack of perspective taking. Obviously, perspective taking is a really big topic, and it's important for a lot of things. But I largely want to focus on how it stands in contrast to mere judgment. When we unilaterally judge someone, we set ourselves as an authority over them and decide that we ought to dictate how they should act or think or be. It is, in effect, saying that our perspective on reality is more important and it should override theirs. And this certainly may be desirable in some cases, right? If we collectively decide to enforce our perspective on a murderer, I don't think that many would object. But if it's indulged in too much, this sort of thing is anathema to building up a vulnerable human connection. And it's also antithetical to forgiveness and the commitment to build a peace. Think about what it takes to let something go or to forgive someone, especially when there are grave wrongs committed on both sides. On the part of both the forgiver and the person seeking forgiveness, they have to come to a mutual understanding on why the other person did what they did or reacted how they did, and how they can be more peaceful moving forward. As Geoffrey Murphy puts it in a paper on the philosophy of forgiveness, the person who cannot forgive is the person who cannot have friends or lovers. In that same paper, Murphy argues that forgiveness relies on the person who has done wrong, demonstrating that they respect the person that they have harmed, and thereby begin to repair the harmed person's self-respect. And this too involves inhabiting the harmed person's perspective. Cathy and Heathcliff's misery ultimately stems from their inability to step outside themselves and into one another. They both feel pretty intensely disrespected, and neither of them can understand the other's agony at this fact. In such situations, affection and love can be a positive obstacle to forgiveness, right? Because it's so much worse and so much more hurtful to feel harmed and disrespected by someone that you love than by a stranger. And in refusing to exit their own viewpoints, Heathcliff and Cathy both fail to realize the broader picture, that they are also victims of circumstances beyond either of their control. When Cathy says that Heathcliff has been brought so low that it would degrade her to marry him, well, Heathcliff overhears this and immediately takes it as a personal rejection. And ultimately, like, who can blame him? But if he could step outside his own viewpoint, he would have realized that this is not something that Cathy was blaming him for. Rather, they were both caught up in a complex network of social relations that made it almost unthinkable for them to be together. But instead, in Heathcliff's own view of the world, it gets transmuted into sheer spite and hatred for Cathy, and this framing never gets questioned. It would be a mistake to think that Heathcliff and Cathy are the only people in the novel who are stuck in their own perspective, because it happens to almost everyone. Hindley is too blinded by his own grief and his own hatred to care how much he is destroying the people around him, and even Nellie is often really blind to the ways in which she brings disaster to those she professes to care about. I mean, she says she cares about Edgar, but that doesn't stop her from smuggling Heathcliff into Thrushcross Grange to see Cathy, and she's often borderline complicit in allowing Heathcliff's schemes to succeed. Joseph, the hyper-religious servant of the Earnshaws, is fixed in a stance of holy judgment of all around him, and it means that he can't see how cruel and brutal and decidedly unchristian he often is. For all these characters, we can encourage them to read that famous verse from the Gospel of Matthew. How wilt thou say to thy brother, let me pull the mote out of thine eye, and behold, a beam is in thine own eye? Many of the problems in Wuthering Heights stem directly from this inability to question one's own viewpoint or take the time to understand any others. Thus, there is very little self-reflection and even less forgiveness. But much like the last section, we are presented with a glimmer of hope in the form of Hareton and the younger Catherine. The way that they go from enemies to friends to lovers is through imperfect attempts to understand one another and ultimately see the world from each other's point of view. At first, for example, Catherine outright mocks Hareton's attempt to learn to read. She is so unhappy in her situation, she can't see that he is trying to get better, and also maybe trying to impress her. However, she learns to see the world through his eyes for a minute, and that changes things. Her conscience reproved her for frightening him off improving himself. She had done it effectually, but her ingenuity was at work to remedy the injury. While I ironed or pursued other such stationary employments as I could not well do in the parlour, she would bring some pleasant volume and read it aloud to me. When Hareton was there, she generally paused in an interesting part and left the book lying about. Eventually, she is the one who helps Hareton learn how to read, and Hareton in turn begins to somewhat protect her from the wrath of Heathcliff. Thus, they are both learning to see the world from one another's point of view, and that changes their behaviour, and in turn, it inevitably brings them closer together. It's easy to see Catherine and Hareton as a sort of a light side rerun of Cathy and Heathcliff, but it's also really important to ask what has changed that allows their union to grow closer, whereas Cathy and Heathcliff couldn't even really be friends in the end. And I would argue that a big part of it is that, in one case, they remained wedded to their own perspectives far too closely to ever attempt to give them up, while in the other case, there was a real willingness to see the world through the eyes of another, and kindness and forgiveness blossomed as a result. Now, obviously, Wuthering Heights is an incredibly rich novel, and you could place any number of themes at its center and end up with a really quite different reading of it. But personally, I choose to see this idea of perspectives and interpretations at the foundation of my reading. Because as far as I can tell, the conflicts, the resolutions, the loves, the hates, the blind spots, the vengeance, and ultimately the forgiveness is driven by the interplay of different perspectives and interpretations of the world. There is how Hindley's interpretation overcomes Mr. Earnshaw's, and how this damages Heathcliff's interpretation of himself, how Cathy and Heathcliff fail to see one another's point of view, and how Hareton and the younger Catherine eventually reconcile. All of this is done through the careful interplay of perspectives, and this theme is reinforced by the fact that we experience the story not first-hand or second-hand, but third-hand and fourth-hand if you count the cultural lens that's been placed over Wuthering Heights by nearly two centuries of readings. So, that's how I personally see the book. Let's look at the film. Okay, you've heard about what I particularly love about the book, what I think makes it so wonderful. Now let's see how the film measures up. I haven't scripted this bit because I've just got back from watching the film for the second time, and I wanted to sort of talk about it while everything was still fresh in my mind and my memory was spot on. I just want to say, I really went into this film really wanting to enjoy it. As many of you who are familiar with the channel might know, I have a real soft spot for things that are being kind of dragged through the town square, as it were. And so I really, really wanted to love this film and be able to put up a staunch defense of it for you for the next 15 or so minutes. Unfortunately, that's not quite what happened. First of all, just things I liked. It looked pretty good. I'm not like a cinematography guy, but you know, it was pretty. I enjoyed the fact that it was pretty. And the first half hour was ultimately pretty nice. It was like quite tightly paced. Overall, I think the first part of the film was relatively fine. Also, I liked the two actors who played Cathy. So the younger Cathy and the older Cathy, Margot Robbie, they were both very good. I think it's very tempting to portray Cathy as like a likable, sympathetic, uncomplicated romantic protagonist. And they didn't do that. They really kind of lent into the fact that she's kind of a crazy brat. And I think that was overall a good thing. I'm glad that they preserved that from the book. The other thing, before we kind of get really stuck into the film, is that when Jacob Elordi came back as Heathcliff returned now rich and he'd shaved his beard and everything, I thought he was doing the mewing face, you know, when people are like, I can't really do it, but you know, when people are like, you know that? I thought he was doing that, but no, it's just the fact that Jacob Elordi is so like comically handsome that he just looks like that, like all the time, regardless of whether or not he's trying. So those are kind of some initial comments. Let's go through each of those themes from the analysis of the book and let's see how the film deals with each of them. So revenge. I think that in many ways, the film's treatment of Heathcliff's revenge is really impoverished compared to the book. First of all, they cut Hindley as a character. So if you remember, Hindley is a large part of what drives Heathcliff's motivations in the book. He's a big part of why Heathcliff wants to take revenge on the world almost so badly. And he's also a big part of why Heathcliff can't be with Cathy. They mesh Hindley and Mr. Earnshaw into one character. And I think that's a real shame because I think that part of what makes Heathcliff's resentment so bitter is the fact that Mr. Earnshaw takes him in and he's part of the household, and then Hindley casts him out again and makes him the lowest of the servants. And we just don't have that anymore, which means that Heathcliff's motivations are much less complicated. They're just, he loves Cathy, he wants to be with her, and he gets upset when he's not with her. And that's all well and good. I'm not saying that's like a bad motivation, but I think it misses a lot of the richness that forms Heathcliff's motivation in the book, which is this kind of overriding resentment and anger and thirst for vengeance. And there really isn't that in the film all that much. I think that's a real shame because I think that, as I said, this theme of revenge and envy is one of the most interesting in the book. I think easily as interesting as the stuff about love and relationships. So I think it's a real shame they cut that. I think the story is slightly poorer for it. The other thing, of course, is that the film is only an adaptation of the first half of the book. And that means that you don't have the contrast between when Cathy is alive and Heathcliff's revenge and wish to get her back almost makes like a little bit of sense. And when Cathy is gone and Heathcliff's revenge becomes just totally self-destructive and there's no rhyme or reason for it anymore. It is just Heathcliff raging against the world, seemingly for little reason at all. You know, that's where the fruitlessness really sets in. And again, we don't quite have that in the film. And I think that's a real shame. So on the whole, I do think the film misses the mark quite a lot in its handling of the theme of revenge. Of course, the second major theme we looked at in the video was that of love. And I think that in some ways the film does this a little bit better, maybe especially at the early parts where you do get a bit of the tense yet affectionate relationship between the younger Cathy and the younger Heathcliff. However, later on in the film, one of the biggest plot changes that they make is that Heathcliff and Cathy have a full-blown affair. And I think that that is a real shame. I think that one of the things that makes Heathcliff and Cathy's relationship so compelling is that it remains totally unfulfilled. They are frustrated and yearning for the whole time that they're alive. And then when Cathy dies, Heathcliff is yearning for a good while after that as well, until he too dies. And here, because they have this affair, it sort of feels like their love has been consummated. It feels like their love has been fulfilled to quite a large extent. And although in the film, Cathy is at this point already pregnant and Heathcliff and her can't like run off together or something like that, I think that nonetheless, you don't get the sense that Heathcliff has been ultimately rejected by Cathy, because in a big way, he hasn't. And again, this really shifts the dynamic compared to the book, because these aren't two people who are totally opaque to themselves, who can't understand quite how much they want one another and love one another and can't get over their own little limited perspective. Because they have an affair, that kind of demonstrates that they were quite self-aware about their emotional state, right? You know, Cathy is conflicted about the affair in the film, but she does go through with it. She decides that she loves Heathcliff enough to break the bond of her marriage. I don't think that's something that book Cathy would do. And I think that's important because I think that it shows Cathy's opacity to herself. She doesn't fully realize how much she loves Heathcliff. And that's part of why when her and Edgar are married, she develops this quite intense animosity towards Heathcliff at points, because that affection gets repressed and is kept slightly beneath explicit awareness. And that's part of what gives birth to this incredibly tumultuous dynamic between the two of them. And that goes for Heathcliff as well, because Heathcliff in the books feels totally rejected by Cathy, whereas in the film, Cathy has accepted him in a lot of ways. And it's not plausible that Heathcliff has this incredible disdain for Cathy at the same time as he loves her. And indeed, when Cathy's death scene happens, a lot of that tension is really missing. And I think that's a real shame. I think that it flattens the story of Cathy and Heathcliff into a sort of straightforward forbidden love tale. And I really don't like that. I think that a lot of the interesting aspects of what are keeping Cathy and Heathcliff apart are the fact that they cannot recognize the complexity of their emotional states around the situation, as we looked at when we were analyzing the book. And the fact that they have an affair really undercuts that as a theme. Additionally, Cathy and Heathcliff's relationship is just massively watered down, I want to say. In that, yeah, there just isn't the same level of mutual animosity as well as mutual adoration. And because we don't have anything post-Cathy's death, we don't see how Heathcliff's love for Cathy continues to affect him in like quite profoundly hurtful ways further down the line. And additionally, because the second half of the book isn't adapted, we are robbed of the contrast medium of Hareton and the younger Catherine. Because, as we said, they're relationship forms a bit of a counterpart to Cathy and Heathcliff's. And again, we don't have that. And that's a shame because it means that the particular aspects of Cathy and Heathcliff's relationship to do with their kind of mutual resentment and anger and how they simply can't get over that aren't brought forward by the presence of another relationship. So I think that this adaptation misses an awful lot of what I find so compelling about the romantic aspects of the book as well. And finally, if we're to look at perspective, which I would argue just is the core of the novel, at least for me when I'm reading it. We don't have much of that at all. I think that this ultimately stems from a couple of different sources, or a few different sources. The first is that there is no sense that the story is being told to Lockwood by Nelly. And so there's not the same kind of double distorting effect of it being told to the reader by two narrations. And as a result, we are not clued in to the idea that perspective is going to be a big part of this tale, in quite the same way as you're kind of unavoidably confronted with the fact that you're being given a particular perspective on a story when you are explicitly introduced to your narrator, who is not omnipotent, who then talks to another character who is also not omniscient. And you are explicitly told that you are being given the story through one character's eyes, and then through another character's eyes, and only then is it being told to you. And again, I think that element is really important to the story, and it is, again, missing from the film. We are seeing the film as sort of like an omniscient narrator would. It's not shown through a particular character's eyes. And additionally, since Hindley is removed, and that battle of perspectives between Hindley and Heathcliff over who Heathcliff is removed, the element of perspective just kind of drops out of the film. What we are left with, in my view, is in many ways a perfectly serviceable story. I don't think that this is a bad film. I don't think it's my favorite film, but I don't think it's an awful film. I think that it will be very overblown, you know, when people say, this is the end of literature or whatever. I think that that is massively overblown. It's a bad adaptation. There are plenty of poor adaptations of things. But I do think that it is a poor adaptation of Wuthering Heights because it fails to really treat any of these three core themes with the level of depth that the novel does. I do want to point out, however, that it is very, very hard to adapt a novel of this complexity and depth. I don't know how I would do it, so I'm not saying that I could do any better of a job. I think in many ways, this film probably would have been better received had it distanced itself even further from the source material. So it has Wuthering Heights in quotation marks, which I think was trying to distance the film from the original source material and thus demonstrate that what it's doing is not adapting Bronte's book in a straightforward way, but rather, you know, taking the loose outlines of the story and then creating something, I'd say, substantially new about it. One of the biggest plot points in the film is this affair that happens between Heathcliff and Cathy, and none of that happens in the book. So I think that it is a substantial retelling rather than a straightforward adaptation. But I think that if they'd have lent into that a bit more, I think people would have been a lot more patient with it. If it wasn't called Wuthering Heights, it was called something entirely different, and then underneath as a subtitle, it had something like a retelling inspired by Wuthering Heights or something like that. I think people would have had a lot more patience for it. Overall, there has been a bit of a media furore around this film, which ultimately, I suppose this video is unfortunately a part of, which I think is an overreaction to the fact that this is ultimately quite a poor adaptation of a classic book, in my view, but is not a disastrous adaptation of a book. And this is not in any sense the end of literature as we know it or anything like that. There have been plenty of bad adaptations in the past, and there'll be plenty of bad adaptations in the future. I think it's important not to get carried away here. Having said that, I do ultimately think that if you are a real fan of the book, I highly doubt that you will find that the film measures up. If you wanted to enjoy the film to its maximum extent, you should think about it as quite a substantial alteration from the original novel, and think of it, yeah, as this loose retelling rather than an adaptation of a book that you already love. It's a bit like how Bridget Jones' Diary is a very loose adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. And I think that if that had been the foot forward that the film had put, I think that people would have a lot more patience with it. But yes, ultimately, I didn't enjoy this film, and I think that it doesn't measure up to the novel because of the three reasons that I have given. So those are my promised hot takes. And now just a few words of conclusion. Amongst the furore and the endless public discourse, it's very easy to just miss the essentials. So if there's one thing to take away from this video, it is to please, please read Wuthering Heights if you haven't done so already. You might come away from it totally disagreeing with my reading of it here, but I can absolutely guarantee that some aspect of the book will leap out at you and wrench control of your mind for a bit. It might be the romance, it might be the perspectives, like it is for me, but it could also be the incredibly sophisticated social commentary on 18th and 19th century England, which we've barely been able to scratch the surface of here because it's its own vein of inquiry that would take another hour or so to even begin talking about. And as for the film, I really want us to steer between two poles. On the one hand, I don't think that it was a great adaptation for the reasons that I've given here. But on the other hand, my fondest hope is that it will ultimately draw people towards this book, and I'm basically certain that if it does, they will enjoy it. And if this occurs, then the film will have been a positive force for the world, in my view. And even if you think the film was the worst thing in the world since unsliced bread, it really isn't the end of literature. And I really think we ought to cling on to that amidst the slightly sensationalist headlines. And if you want to learn some other ideas about romance which might help you in your own relationships and give us some historical perspective on the discourse around love today, then check out my video on how love has always been deeply embarrassing right here. Thank you so much for watching and have a wonderful day.